Alive and Kicking with Claire McKenna on News Talk.
Yes, you can email the show, aliveandkicking@newstalk.com, or you will find me on Twitter and Instagram. I'm at Claire McKenna Presents. Coming up this morning, the fabulous pharmacist Laura Dowling and women's health physio Aoife Harvey on their crusade to get life-changing medication available over the counter. And Dr. Rachel Clark on the heart transplant between 2 9-year-old children that changed legislation and inspired her to make it the subject of her latest book, The Story of a Heart. So what kind of a health and wellness week did I have? It's been another busy week, more Lunchtime Live, and I was in Galway for self-care sessions with VIP magazine during the week, and I loved it. Bianca Likes is the editor of the magazine, and we not only grew up in the same area, but we actually worked together early in our careers in a radio production company. So I always loved to be in her company, and it was great for our working lives to come back together for this event and get to hang out together. Thank you to all the lovely people who I met on the night. I love when I get to meet listeners of the show. I'll have to make it back to Galway for another wellness event soon, not least because my best friend lives there, Irene, and she was, of course, in the audience on Thursday, which was much appreciated. And do you find that friendships get more challenging as you get older? I know it can be a positive thing for your circle to grow smaller but be filled with quality over quantity. But I certainly found in my 20s, it was all socialising and friendship groups. And you just end up in all of the same places. It seemed to come easy. You were like a friend magnet. 30s for me, lots of us, I suppose, had young families together. So that would bring us together at various soft play centres, parks, or out on the town when the kids were tucked up with babysitters. And, you know, even my friends that didn't have kids, you know, you were just more available to meet up with them and escape the humdrum of mad family life. 40s, everything's ramped up somewhat. There's no tucking any kids up at 7. Work has taken a step up and commitments just seem to be more. And maybe, dare I say it, the older you get, the tireder you get. So at the end of the week, staying in can be favoured to catch your breath. So of the friends who have weathered the storm, I am very grateful to have them all by my side. And as connection is one of the pillars of our health and well-being, I will actually always endeavour to push through, keep saying yes to the occasions and minding the friendship circle, but still be up for growing it as much as I can too. You can email the show, aliveandkicking@newstalk.com. Now, I have Laura Dowling, the fabulous pharmacist, and women's health physio Aoife Harvey in studio with me. You are both very welcome, ladies.
Thank you.
Thank you.
And the last time I saw you two together was at Viva La Vulva at the National Concert Hall. Absolutely loved it. You both gave very impassioned speeches about women's health based on your own experience, and you came out to amazing songs. You came out to Mandinka by Sinead O'Connor, Laura. You came out to, I believe, was it Maniac 2000?
Aoife? Yes.
And she is just that.
She represents my personality best.
And I just loved it because it was so informative, so heartfelt and so moving and yet so entertaining. And you were so smart and clever and on it. And yet the legs were out, the sequins were on, and it was just everything. So I'm delighted to have you back on. Thank you both so much for joining together, because you're joining forces for something else you're very passionate about, and it's making vaginal estrogen available over the counter. When did you both start talking about this?
As soon as Aoife and I met each other, which was online, as people do these days, we started talking about the necessity for vaginal estrogen and the fact that it should really be available OTC in Ireland like it is in the UK.
And what is vaginal estrogen, and what would it help with, Aoife?
So it's a really tiny dose of estradiol, and it's like 10 milligrams, micrograms. So it is a tiny, tiny dose, and it's just a local estrogen. It goes into the vagina via a cream, a gel, or a little tablet, and it dissolves overnight, and it does not go into your system. So it's not like systemic HRT, you know, that actually goes into your bloodstream. So it goes into the vagina and gets absorbed into the bladder. It will help women, and there's 80% of women after menopause that will experience these genital urinary symptoms post-menopause. So 8 out of 10. So we just want all women to be on it, to help with things like painful intercourse, dryness, itching, burning symptoms. they can get so painful that they can't even have an examination with a physio or a gynecologist or a doctor. But then there is massive help for bladder symptoms, which a lot of people don't realise. And that can be urgency of your bladder, recurrent UTIs, and even mild stress incontinence. Like if women have gone through menopause and then they start to get bladder issues, it's often related to the fact that their estrogen levels are low. So it is magic. When you see a woman who's been on it for 6 weeks, you're like, is this the same lady? Like, it is amazing.
And can I just say, I did think at the start, should I say we're going to be discussing sensitive information? Because obviously genitalia are different to other body parts. But we do have certain, you know, sensitivities around that. We're not allowed to walk around the streets naked.
Well, this is true, yeah. But we need to talk about them more.
And I didn't think about that when I've had guests on to talk about Viagra and erectile dysfunction. I didn't think about saying it's going to be sensitive information. We just spoke about it, which it's worth noting is available over the counter. So why isn't this available? Why isn't vaginal estrogen available over the counter in pharmacies?
Who knows? It's not considered to be important enough, I think. I really do think that. And it should be. Aoife has just spoken about the importance of it in managing genital urinary syndrome of the menopause. And I think that when people think about vaginal estrogen, they often think, oh, sex, or, you know, it's to help with sex. Actually, I think sex is probably the last thing on our minds when we're thinking about how it can help women. I see in the pharmacy regularly women that are on regular antibiotics for UTIs. And when they are put on a vaginal estrogen, they do not need those antibiotics anymore. So it can help so much. But I think, just like everything, it comes down to the fact that women's health isn't and hasn't been on the agenda for so very long in this country, around the world. But it takes lobbying, it takes discussions like this, and it takes people coming together to really try and get our agenda across so that every woman can feel empowered when it comes to their health. And you mentioned Viagra there, and I just have to tell you something about that as well. So interestingly enough, the Women's Health Initiative study came out, or the results and the findings that came out in the early 2000s. And that was in and around the time when Viagra was first put on the market. Okay, so you had women that were being taken off their HRT and experiencing all of the symptoms that were associated with that, or women that were never being put on HRT. We think that one or two generations actually of women missed out on HRT and HRT education as a result of that study coming out, which, you know, actually said that HRT causes cancer and caused an awful lot of worry and concern. So women were taken off HRT in around the same time that Viagra was being put on the market. So you had women in relationships that were experiencing all these kinds of symptoms, as well as the psychological symptoms. They're experiencing all kinds of vaginal symptoms and sexual symptoms, and their partners were able to get erections when they may not have been able to otherwise. And we haven't even looked into the psychological damage that this would have had on women and their self-confidence and the effects it would have had in relationships. So there is a huge dearth of information when it does come to women's health. And I think it's now we're seeing it. You know, we have the announcement by the minister that HRT will be free in the new year. Hopefully, we'll see what that kind of looks like. They have yet to set out the criteria. But I think that it's just so very important that we keep this conversation moving and we never stop talking about it, because once you sit back, things just settle and we can't have that.
Laura, will you tell the story of the woman you spoke about at Viva La Vulva, who had gone, I think you said it was something like 15 years in great discomfort? Because I think it's important for people to hear that story, and that she represents so many women.
She does. And she is a representation of so many women that would have come into me. So this was a lady that was coming into me, and she came into me over the period of a month for some thrush cream. She thought she had thrush. So after the third box that I gave her of thrush cream, I actually said to her, listen, I actually do not think that this is thrush. If you're treating it the way you should be treating it, it should have been gone at this stage. So I think that you probably have something else going on. I took a little look at just the front area of her vulva, and I could see that there was maceration there, that there was dryness. She was very uncomfortable. She couldn't ride a bike anymore, and that was the way she used to exercise. She was sore to wipe. Sometimes when she went for a wee, she just had to spray herself down. She couldn't wipe because it was so sore and sensitive, and she hadn't had sexual intercourse with her husband for about 15 years. And when she went to her doctor and got her prescription for her vaginal estrogen and started using it, within 3 months, she was really feeling very well. She was, you know, all that discomfort had gone. And then within, I think it was about 5 or 6 months, she was back having sex with her husband after a 15-year hiatus. You know, and that is real life. They are real women. And Aoife sees women like this all the time. And Aoife sees younger women. That woman was in her 70s. Aoife sees younger women that have this issue, because Aoife is examining these women every day.
Because it's the lack of knowledge, isn't it, Aoife? Because, you know, I learned loads sitting listening to your talk. And you, if you get people, I think they're almost ahead of the curve, that they've got to the stage that they've got to a women's health physio. Loads of people don't even know that such a thing exists.
Oh my goodness, can I just say, women's health physios are the most underrepresented, as in, you know, and underutilized health professionals in this country.
And here we are, like, having babies. And I know not every woman is going to have a baby. But, you know, there's a lot going on down there. I mean, it should be checked.
Every woman has a pelvic floor. Every woman has a pelvic floor and a vagina and a vulva. And our pelvic floor, regardless of whether or not we have babies, slackens as we go through menopause. And that's where someone like Aoife can come in and really help with the likes of incontinence, the likes of prolapse. But vaginal estrogen can really help with those things too, and that's why we're here.
And there are some younger women, because there's women with like early ovarian insufficiency. There are women who are on contraceptive pills stopping them ovulate that are having painful intercourse. And when I link up with really good doctors that are open-minded to give younger women vaginal estrogen, so we do it. Women who are breastfeeding, by the way, will have low estrogen levels and they cannot tolerate intercourse, or their scars are painful from their tears and they don't realise it's a lack of estrogen. So I always say to women, you go from pregnancy to menopause when you're breastfeeding. It's like, it's hard enough to have a baby and do all those other things, but you're actually in this low state of estrogen. So they get hot sweats and brain fog and all these symptoms like menopause while they mind a baby, you know, and have sleepless nights.
It's just so mind-blowing that this stuff isn't talked about until now, until you two and other people like you. So what's at the centre of this then? Does this sadly come down to money? Why can we get Viagra over the counter and we can't get vaginal estrogen?
Well, like, at the moment, vaginal estrogen is available over the counter in the UK, which I think really helps our cause, because when our neighbours are already doing it, and I was reading yesterday, like, their government did a big consultation and they got like 1,200 replies from doctors and pharmacists. They said they'd never had so many replies in a medical consultation before. And 88% of the responses said they were very pro over the counter vaginal estrogen. So it's available over there and it's called Gina. And it is the exact same as Vagifem, right? So it's 10 micrograms of a dose. So they have it over the counter, but in Ireland, we have a totally different system to them. So in the NHS, people go to see their GPs for free. The medicines over there are capped at a price and things were free there, like pills were free there before us. So here, it's actually a commercial kind of more viable in Ireland because people pay for things, don't hate us. But what we've done so far, because we were so passionate about, like, we have to get this over the counter. Why do we want it over the counter? We just want women to be able to go in and get it themselves, you know? We're not saying every doctor won't provide it if they go in and talk to them, but we just want women to be able to access it without going to see a doctor because it's so safe. So if they come to see me, Claire, I have to send them back to get a prescription, and that's a cost, you know?
Yeah.
And then they're like, why can't you prescribe it? Why can't I just go in and get it? I'm like, I'm really sorry. So I said, like, it's going to take years for physios to be able to prescribe, but maybe we can lobby to get it over the counter and that's how we'll get it for you. So what we've done so far, the local elections were on and Harris had just come in as Taoiseach. So we got on our social medias and said, anyone who's knocking on your door, anyone you see at the supermarket, go up and talk to them about vaginal estrogen. And then poor Connor, who's Harris's kind of assistant or PR person, we all started emailing Connor. Thousands of us. So Connor and the Taoiseach's office, they did write into the HPRA. They told us, the HPRA, like, we are going to write to them and ask, how can we get vaginal estrogen over the counter? And the HPRA came back and said, it has to be a private company. So the company that basically manufacture and distribute Gina, they're the ones that have to come to the HPRA. So now we are trying to lobby that company and we're trying to show them that there's a massive commercial need for it in Ireland. And if they went to the effort to bring it here over the counter, that obviously they will make money, but more importantly, the women will be much happier and have access to it themselves.
So how can we get involved to help you? How can the women listening now who think, yes, this is important, how can they let your cause know that there is a market there?
So we have a petition that you can sign up to. It's on both our Instagrams. Aoife is known as
Women's Health Dublin.
And I am at Fabulous Pharmacist. And we have a petition and a link in there. And we're going to put that out regularly online as well and show people that it's there if they sign up. We will, and the more signatures that we get, the more obvious it'll be that there is definitely a necessity for it. And I just want to say something else, right? If men's penises were drying up, if they were incontinent, if they couldn't perform sexually as a result of dryness, itchiness, soreness, do you think that there'd be something done about it? That it would be something would be available for them, OTC? I'm actually convinced something would be available for free on the corner of every street if men's penises were impacted the way women's vaginal health is impacted with this low estrogen levels post-menopause. So I think that if people kind of thought of that, they would actually see how important it really is that we can get this over-the-counter for women so they can access it themselves and they can take it correctly and use it the way it should be. And, you know, interesting enough, there are women in nursing homes, older women in nursing homes, that are suffering regularly with UTIs, and they would benefit so much from vaginal estrogen, and it's just not used. It's like there's a lack of awareness across the board with it. But we're trying to just get everyone aware about how it can help people. And even I've had people come into me and tell me that when they heard stuff that Aoife and I had said online, or they may have been to Viva La Vulva, and they went into their nursing home and said, my mother has had 6 UTIs in the last year. And, you know, UTIs can send older people a little bit
they can really affect their mind.
Absolutely. And once they got them on it, they changed.
And you're so right, more hospital stays. I mean, it's a win-win.
It's going to save everyone money in the long run. I think that is so very important. So we really need to push this agenda.
And I'd like to say as well that it's not just women who need to sign this petition. This is an everybody, like 100%. Man, woman, however you identify. This is a health issue.
Yeah. It is. And men love their girlfriends. They love their partners. They love their wives. They just want them to be happy. They really do. So absolutely, the men need to get involved too. And, you know, it's so very important. And this isn't a men against women issue. This isn't a Viagra against Vagifem issue. But we're just trying to show the disparities in the way we talk about women's health versus the way we talk about men's health. But like Aoife and I both love men. Men have got us into serious trouble over the years. And I live in a family full of men. I love them, you know.
You had the health minister in front of you at your podcast recently.
Did you bring
this up? I'm halfway through listening to it. He's an excellent communicator. I'll certainly give him that.
He is. Look, the vaginal estrogen thing is something that needs to be discussed. Really, it really does. And loads of people need to bring it to the minister to talk to him about it. It isn't just one lowly pharmacist can bring it to him. He knows about it. He absolutely does. I think he has so much on his agenda at the minute, and I'm not going to speak for him, but trying to get the HRT over the line is the first thing. And just to let you know as well, like, vaginal estrogen isn't considered to be HRT because it acts locally. HRT is something that people take and it acts systemically. So it's either the patch or the tablet. And then another interesting fact, if you're using the vaginal estrogen for a year, okay, you have the same systemic absorption, which means the same amount of estrogen that will be absorbed into your bloodstream as you would if you took one HRT tablet.
Wow, so it's so small.
It is
so
tiny.
Because I know there's a lot of women who may have had breast cancer that can't take HRT, and there's other people that it just doesn't work out for. Vaginal estrogen is okay for them.
Yes, and there was a study done recently in Scotland and in Wales. It was, I think, about 50,000 women. And it studied that risk with breast cancer, et cetera, and it came out that actually it is safe. Now, it's taken on an individual basis, and women should definitely speak to their oncologists about it. But there are a lot of women menopause providers now that are happy to prescribe vaginal estrogen for ladies that have been through cancer that literally cannot take anything else, but their vagina, their vulva is not working or not feeling the way it should, and that does help them.
Well, I'd have to say I'd jump on board any train you two were at the helm of. You're going to try and bring back Viva La Vulva. There'll be more dates and more
fun. We are bringing
fun.
It back, actually, but we're not going to... I can't divulge the date just yet, but we are bringing it back 2025.
Watch
March.
This space. So sign the petition, get on board, go to @ Women's Health Physio, @ The Fabulous Pharmacist, and you'll find that petition there. Aoife Harvey, Women's Health Physio, and Laura Dowling, The Fabulous Pharmacist and owner of Fabu Wellness. Thank you so much for coming on.
Thank you.
Thank you.
Alive and kicking on News Talk.
Now, possibly the most moving book I have ever read, The Story of a Heart, documents a heart transplant between 2 9-year-old children, Max and Kira, the set of circumstances that led their lives to be intertwined,
and all the people in their lives along the way. It's written by Dr. Rachel Clark, and she joins me on the line now. Rachel, you're very welcome.
Thank you very much.
What an incredible piece of work. How you pulled all of that together. I have been so moved reading every line of it. So congratulations on that. What a book. And also, what a story. Tell us about when you were first drawn to the story of Max and Kira and the heart transplant between 2 9-year-olds.
Well, it was in 2017 when it all happened in real time, and I saw the front page of the Mirror newspaper was filled with little Max Johnson's face, 9 years old. He'd been on the transplant list for nearly 9 months, and he was so sick that the family were appealing for a heart. And then a couple of months later, he appeared again, all pink and radiant, and he'd had this precious life-saving surgery. And then the thing that made me want to write the book was a third front page when little Kira, the child who died, a little girl aged 9, and gave Max her heart. Kira's family met Max's family, and one by one, her mum and dad and siblings all listened with a stethoscope to her heart beating inside the chest of the little boy that she had saved. And I thought that story is extraordinary, and I couldn't imagine a more incredible story to tell.
And you spend a lot of time in the book exploring how truly selfless and altruistic organ donation is. I mean, you say there is no purer act of giving, and it is so true.
It really is, because if you think about it, particularly if a child is involved, that family are going through absolutely hellish times. They've found out that their loved one has suffered catastrophic injuries. They can't survive. They are brain dead, but they have this opportunity to gift their organs to other children or adults who are desperately in need and would die without those organs. But for a family in that situation to somehow look beyond their grief and think, I could do something good. I could have a living legacy, and my child could help other children to live. It's a truly astonishing thing. None of us know how we'd react in that situation. And it just shows, I think, the absolute best of humanity.
Now, you say you wanted to put the heart at the centre of the story, and you tell the story of everyone involved in the transplant and the lead up to that, from the family members you've mentioned to the medical staff. And to do that, you conducted hours of interviewing and are at pains to say that there's no dramatisation or conjecture in this book. This is the story as it was told to you. So what was that process like?
Well, I can honestly say it was an honour to conduct those interviews. Kira and Max's families, they put their trust in me. They trusted me to tell their story, and I will never stop feeling the responsibility of that, and also gratitude to them both. It was very emotional conducting these interviews. The medical staff involved were absolutely phenomenal. So just for example, Max's heart surgeon, Asif Hassan, who conducted the transplant surgery, he's one of the most incredible and most renowned heart surgeons in Europe. And yet he's this incredibly humble man. He's in a sort of typical shabby, tiny NHS office, which he shares with someone else. There's an old sofa that looks incredibly moth-eaten. And if he's working all night, he might lie down briefly and have a nap on his moth-eaten sofa. And yet he does these incredible things. He takes a scalpel to a child's chest. He lifts out a child's heart and stitches back in another one. And the behind the scenes of everything that the NHS achieves to make a transplant happen is just the most nail-biting, tense, suspenseful story you could ever imagine.
Now, there's a review on the cover of this book by Rob Delaney, and it says, "Rare the writer who could pull this story together so beautifully." And it's true. You weave together the story of Max, the virus in his heart, making his health decline so rapidly, the motor accident involving Kira, her mum and her brother, which leads to her being in the paediatric ICU. And then, as you say, all the people they meet along the way, the medical staff, people at the scene of the accident, and all the medical understanding every step of the way. I mean, it can't have been an easy process for you.
No, it was a real challenge because as well as Max and Kira's story, I've woven in the incredible medical breakthroughs over the last 100 years that have enabled us to transplant organs. If you take a step back for a minute and just think about the idea of removing organs from somebody, flying them hundreds of miles away, halfway around the country, and then saving the life of someone else by transplanting them. 100 years ago, that was science fiction. No doctor believed that would ever be possible. So there's this incredible story of how doctors and scientists, real mavericks who were obsessed with this idea of transplant, worked away to try and figure out how to stop the body rejecting a transplanted organ. How do you even stitch together two blood vessels? And a surgeon in France 100 years ago spoke to the best embroidery expert in Paris and said, teach me your skills. How do you embroider so delicately? And then he applied those skills to blood vessels. So there's that story. And then Kira and Max's story sort of unfolds more gently and with much more emotion. And I just tried to weave the two together so that you were learning and you were feeling. And at the heart of this story literally was Kira's incredible, beautiful heart.
I loved the medical understanding that you gave everything. I mean, being a doctor yourself, you give it the detail it deserves, but it's always really easy to understand. And, you know, you mentioned the embroidery story there. There was another story of a man performing heart surgery and he had to do it in real time. He could only put the stitches in during every offbeat. I mean, it was just mind-blowing, some of the facts that I was learning along the way.
Exactly. And I think sometimes as a doctor, you don't just have to understand science. You have to be able to communicate it to patients and have conversations with them that are clear and helpful and understandable. And I think I tried to bring all of my medical training into the telling of this story, because you're absolutely right. For most of human history, doctors looked at the heart and thought, well, it's impossible to operate on the heart because it never stops moving. It never stops beating. And what changed that actually was the Second World War. There were so many horrible battlefield injuries, you know, shrapnel and bullets into the heart, that a particular American surgeon decided to try and operate and remove these bits of shrapnel and bullets from a beating heart. So he would literally cut into the chest, cut into the heart, and while it was moving, pull out a bit of bullet and try and stitch it up again. And of course, you'd have to do that in seconds almost, and his patient survived. And then gradually, doctors worked out that the only way to do more complicated surgery would be to stop the heart. So they started to think about, how can you stop the heart without killing the patient? The patient still needs oxygen getting to their brain and all of their other organs. And then in the 1950s, eventually doctors worked out how to build a ventilator, a machine to do the work of the lungs while they were operating on a heart that they had stopped beating. And all of that is just eye-poppingly astonishing. And it's a really tense story, and it's filled with these huge egos. These early heart surgeons, particularly in the 1960s, they were all men. They were all kind of bristling with ambition and machismo and determination to be first. Everybody was obsessed with the race to put a first man on the moon. But the other big race of the 1960s was, who will be the first man to transplant a human heart? And they were utterly devoted to being first. And Christian Barnard, the surgeon who was first turned overnight into a global superstar. He was like a kind of global rock star. He was the Taylor Swift of heart surgery. And it's just an incredible story.
And the book is full of incredible stories like that. You're right. I had my mind blown by the story of Ibsen, the first person to ventilate a patient during the polio epidemic. I mean, to set up a pump that needed to be pumped by hand, 1,500 volunteers taking six-hour shifts 24/7 to manually pump the bags that kept people's lungs going. I mean, these are just things that we begin to take for granted. I mean, you do point out in the book that ventilators became the currency during the pandemic when there were people who couldn't get access to one. So we don't always take them for granted. But I don't think many of us know the stories behind these medical procedures.
No.
Will you tell the story of the pilot whose family were injured, some of them fatally, in a crash that changed emergency medicine in many ways?
Yes. Well, this is an absolutely astonishing story. So today, if there is a terrible car crash or another trauma, a bombing, something like that, then everybody, all the first responders, the medics, paramedics, they all know exactly what to do. They follow a particular protocol, which is the right way to act to save as many people as possible in a moment of crisis. Because what happens in a crisis is everyone panics. And if they don't have a framework, people panic and therefore patients die. And that framework was invented all the way back in the 1960s when an American surgeon who happened to also be a pilot crashed his plane and his wife was killed on impact, his four children, and he survived. But his four children were desperately injured, severely injured. And he managed to drag his way through the frozen plains of Nebraska to get to a road and thumbed a lift with a couple of people in a truck who picked up his desperately unwell children and drove them to a little rural hospital that had an A&E but wasn't even open at night. He had to bang on the door with his blood-stained hands and beg them to open the doors. There weren't even any doctors in this little rural hospital. And the nurses called a couple of doctors from the town who arrived from their sleep. And they looked at these four children with their serious injuries and they panicked. They didn't know what to do. They lifted up one of his children with serious head and neck injuries and they didn't even support his spine. And the surgeon, Steiner was his name, was absolutely horrified. Miraculously, eventually the children survived, but only after he phoned his friends in a big hospital and got all of his children airlifted out to safety. And he decided at that moment, I am going to come up with an algorithm, a protocol for how people conduct themselves in an emergency like this. And he called it ATLS, Advanced Trauma Life Support. And it was incredibly successful. It started in one state. It spread across the whole of America. And now it has spread across the whole of the world. So I have, as a first-year doctor, I did an ATLS, Advanced Trauma Life Support course. And it's exactly the same as the course doctors do in America, in India, in China. And we all now use this same algorithm to save lives. He has literally saved thousands, probably hundreds of thousands of lives through this course. And now everybody takes it for granted that you learn this approach to trauma, but it is literally an innovation that has saved hundreds of thousands of lives worldwide. And anybody who's in an emergency, an accident, if they knew this, they would thank their lucky stars that James Steiner came up with this brilliant idea, because he is what makes us all work in a calm, controlled way in a crisis. And that is exactly what the junior doctor who arrived on the scene of poor Kira's car crash, he used it. He had done this course about 6 months earlier and he put it into practice and he saved Kira's life on the scene. And she was able to get to a hospital still with her heart beating.
So incredible to get that human story behind that, that, as you say, still ripples out to save lives today. Now, the book is obviously an emotional read. I was deeply moved. It's, of course, very difficult in parts what each child
was going through the most difficult, Kira in ICU, and while her heart is beating, scans show there's no activity in the brain. And I think it can be very hard, particularly, of course, for the family to get their head around the idea that while their loved one may look like they're sleeping, they will not survive. And you do explain that so well, that the heart beating is so important, but the brain really is the control centre.
Exactly. So it's really, really hard for families because they will be looking at their loved one in intensive care and they don't look like they're dead at all. Their heart is beating, they're breathing because they're on a ventilator, they're warm, they're pink, and they look like they're sleeping. They look like they're just going to open their eyes at any moment. And that's what Kira's family thought when they were watching her. Her sisters were snuggled up to her in bed, painting her nails, brushing her hair, singing to her. And it felt as though she was just sleeping. The tragedy is that you can be in that state but have no brain activity at all. So normally, if you have a severe catastrophic brain injury, the centres in the brain that control our breathing stop working. And so you no longer breathe, your heart stops and you die. And all of those three things happen together: brain death, the lungs not working and the heart stopping beating. The ventilator means that even though the brain has stopped completely and there are no signals coming from the brain telling the lungs to breathe, the ventilator is doing the work instead. So the lungs are still being pushed in and out by the ventilator. And that means that it's possible to be completely brain dead, but for your body to still work, your lungs to work by the ventilator and your heart to carry on beating. And it's a very, very unusual set of circumstances. It's only existed since the 1950s when ventilators were invented. And it's a tragedy. It's so hard for families, but it does mean that there's this amazing opportunity because you can sit with a family and very, very sensitively and gently explain what's happening, explain that there's no brain activity, the brain has died, but there is this opportunity to save other lives with the organs. And the NHS has a particular staff member, the specialist nurses in organ donation, who are trained to have these conversations. And I honestly think they are the most amazing people in the NHS. They're so kind, they're so sensitive. And they sit down and have these conversations with families. Nobody is ever pressured in any way. No one would ever have the organs of their loved one taken without their permission. But those conversations will happen and it's up to the family to choose. And one thing that we hope will come from the book is that hopefully people will have that conversation, particularly with their children. If you ask children, would they like to be a donor? Almost always they say, yes, of course I would. Why are you even asking me that? And it's really good to find out your loved one's wishes, because at any moment, 250 children in the UK are on the transplant list. And of course, every year, some of them die because they don't get the organs they need. So it's a really difficult, emotional, devastating time for families. But often, if they make the decision to donate, they take immense comfort from that. So Kira's family are so glad she became a donor, and every day they think of her. And they told me every day they think of Max, and they know that a part of Kira is living on in Max, and that gives them huge comfort.
And of course, Kira, Max and their families remain at the centre of the book throughout. But I wanted to say something about the importance of the stories you tell of the medical staff involved. I mean, sometimes it's a little of their personal story woven into their chosen profession and their expertise. And I think to represent that is so important. We do hear positive stories of the brilliant people working within the health service, but too often I think we also hear of how lacking it all is. So I just thought it was so lovely to have an insight into these incredible people. You mentioned the organ donation staff and how well they are trained and the magic that they perform working in such stressful and difficult, tragic circumstances. Staff dancing around the ICU ward because Max loved dance music.
the staff who worked tirelessly to get Ciara to the same hospital as her family so that they could all be together. I just thought it was so amazing to hear that. And often, I mean, you mentioned the surgeon who carried out the heart transplant, and you painted a picture of him in his office. And I just thought it was a really beautiful thing for you to do, because many of us, thankfully, don't get to see that work. And I thought it was really important that it was marked the way you did it.
Yes, I loved that aspect of telling the story, because we've all heard those terrible stories of you know, trolleys and corridors, patients not managing to get the ambulances they need. And of course, that's true. We know that things are very pressured. But I think that makes it even more remarkable that right now, at any moment, night and day, there are transplant teams going out there, coordinating different teams, different hospitals all over the country, and doing these miraculous life-saving transplant surgeries. And the people involved, without exception, and I interviewed everybody, they're not just doing a job. They are so utterly devoted to this mission of ensuring that this precious, precious organ will successfully survive and be transplanted into a person, because they know it's literally life and death. And they all go the extra mile. So one of the nurses who cared for Ciara, she stayed, on a day of leave, she wanted to come in and stay with Ciara and see it through and support her family. And after her surgery, when the surgeons finished and left the theatre, the nurses spent time lovingly washing Kira's hair, rubbing scented hand cream into her hands, putting her in a beautiful party dress that her father had chosen for her, so that when her family saw her again, she was a beautiful princess. And that's not anything you do because you're paid to do it. You do that because you love these families, you care about them, you want to support them. And I think that degree of just quiet, unsung compassion and devotion to patients and their families, and it's easy to forget that that's still there. And this story just brims over with the absolute best of people, people stepping up to terrible circumstances with such courage and grace and just real spirit of generosity. It's a really uplifting story.
It really is. And of course, the legacy is that Max and Ciara's law, the Organ Donor Act, was written into law on the 20th of May 2020, and the opt-out system came into being. So that legacy of the altruism of Ciara's family will continue to be felt as it has been over the last few years and on. I can't recommend the book highly enough. If you are struggling with the amount of hate you're seeing in the world right now, this is the book you need to read. It will restore your faith in human nature and it will stir your soul. I will never forget it. Dr. Rachel Clark, thank you so much for writing. It's called The Story of the Heart, and it's really been an honour to talk to you about it today.
Thank you so much.
And thank you to all my guests today. That's it for Alive and Kicking for this week. Thanks to my producer, Aidan McKelvey, and to Hugo Da Silva Scott, who was on sound. And thanks to you for listening. I will see you next week.
Alive and Kicking with Claire McKenna. Sunday morning at 8 on News Talk.